Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm very excited about the speakers we have to discuss the basic principles around advertising technology online and also some specific issues about how that affects children. So to start out, we have two guests from Common Sense Media. We have Ariel Fox Johnson, who is the Senior Counsel for Global Privacy at Common Sense Media, where she advocates for smart practices, policies, and rules to help all kids thrive in today's wired world. Her work focuses on enhancing family privacy rights, strengthening students' educational privacy, and promoting robust consumer protections in the online world. She frequently advises policymakers, industry, and tech experts, and has helped develop laws on student privacy, consumer privacy, and the Internet of Things. Ariel's a graduate of Harvard College and Law School, and prior to joining Common Sense, she worked on privacy, media, intellectual property, and technology matters at corporate law firms and provided pro bono assistance to nonprofits and asylum seekers. So welcome and thank you for joining us, Ariel. We also have Joseph Jerome. And Joe serves as Director, Platform Accountability and State Advocacy at Common Sense Media, where he focuses on common sense legislative and policy solutions that support kids' digital well-being. Joseph has worked at the intersection of law and technology and has written about AR, VR, and the implications of privacy and big data. Data portability policy, trust deficits in the online sharing economy, and emerging technologies in video games. Previously, he was part of the Privacy and Data Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology, an associate in the cybersecurity and privacy practice at WilmerHale, and counsel at the Future of Privacy Forum. He was a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry and has taught courses on cybersecurity and privacy compliance. Joseph has a JD from the New York University School of Law, where he was an international law and human rights student fellow. So with that in mind, you should be able to unmute yourselves now, and I'd love to turn it off to you. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alex. And thank you, Georgia, for hosting us here today. Just a little bit of background on Common Sense. We're a leading nonprofit dedicated to helping kids and families thrive in an increasingly digital world. Most people know us for our ratings and reviews, helping families and caregivers to pick the right books, TV shows, and games for their children. And we also have a huge education presence where we work with schools and teachers so they can incorporate digital technology thoughtfully into their classrooms or into students' homes, as may have been the case more recently. We have an award-winning digital citizenship curriculum, teaching kids how to be safe, smart, and effective online. We evaluate education technology products for privacy and also for educational effectiveness. And we have an advocacy and policy team, which is where Joe and I sit, where we're constantly pressing policymakers and companies to do better to protect young people online. For years, we have been calling out issues about information collection with respect to children. It used to be that companies would collect what kids did online, browsing histories, emails. Now it's online and offline, browsing histories, emails, purchases, your location, any sort of seemingly innocuous or other piece of information about you. Companies and other entities are collecting online and using it to profile and to target kids, primarily with advertisements. We think that's inappropriate. And we're part of, we see a growing awareness of this and opposition to these practices. The next slide is great, thanks. Just in the last couple of years, we have seen European formerly European commissioners at the ICO in the UK announce investigations into real-time privacy and bidding concerns. We've seen vocal consumer opposition to a business model that's based on surveilling individuals and collecting information about them. And we've seen companies like Apple, and if you want to go to the next slide, that's great, thanks. We've seen companies like Apple who are trying to make a name for themselves. I still see the same slide, maybe I'm the only one. We've seen companies like Apple and others trying to stake a name for themselves in terms of privacy. And just this spring, we saw Apple announce new privacy controls for consumers, where it would allow consumers to decide whether or not they wanted other companies and other third-party apps to collect information about them while they're using the apps, such as your geolocation. So the online advertising world is a really, really complicated place. And for that, I think we're now going to turn to Joe, who's going to do a little bit of background about real-time bidding and ad tech and sort of high-level overview of how this all works.
Awesome. Thank you, Ariel. So why are we here? What is behavioral advertising and why is it problematic? I'm going to rely on Alex and Ariel to keep me from getting too into the weeds or frankly speaking too quickly, because in some respects, advertising is the internet's original sin, and there's a long and detailed history of how advertising and opportunities to sort of pay for all of the online services that people take advantage of have really led to a whole lot of sort of negative externalities and really problematic and unintended consequences. I think so many of the problems that we are seeing across how society is intersecting with technology and family and kids are intersecting with technology, whether this is through machine learning, artificial intelligence, content moderation. All of this is, I think, in some respects, a byproduct of a business model that is premised on collecting as much data as possible and then monetizing that through engagement and aggressively barraging people with ads. Advertising is at a 10,000 foot level about reaching people who want a product. Advertising has always been about playing on consumers' emotions. If anyone has ever seen the sort of the AMC show Mad Men, manipulation sort of goes hand in hand with marketing. Hey, online Joe, yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just found out I'm not sharing the right screen here. So give me just a moment and let me catch people up with the slides. Sorry about that.
Well, if the slide deck is the most entertaining portion of the event, we're in real trouble.
How about now? Are we seeing the what is advertising technology slide?
That is great. Yeah, okay. I see that now too.
Good. All right. Sorry about that.
So online advertising, I think, kicks up the dynamic that has long been embedded in advertising. Going back to the beginning when banner ads first started appearing on the internet, almost 30 years ago now, there were banner ads and these little online cookies. And cookies are small text files on your computer that allow websites to remember visitors. So for example, if you put something in a shopping cart, or basically effectively allowed websites to become more personalized because anytime someone visited, they could remember if that person had been there before. That personalization and that functionality also meant that cookies were a way to track people. And on top of that premise became a more and more complicated ecosystem. And I think it's really important to understand that a huge amount of information is involved here. Web browsing, yes, but you're also, companies and advertisers are also getting more details from the ability of all of us to log into accounts like Facebook or Google. You add on top of that sort of the mobile revolution of the past 15 years. So now you're getting all sorts of data from mobile apps. Increasingly, you're able to bring in offline data from purchases and data brokers. And then you can add to that a whole bunch of technical information like geolocation history. And the end result of all of this is that a whole bunch of companies can develop, or they can claim they can develop, an incredibly detailed digital portrait of our lives. That's the lives of absolutely everyone, your spouse, your kids, your family, your friends. this is all incredibly complicated. And so I always think it's important in any conversation about data privacy or digital advertising, no presentation is complete unless you show everyone the Lumascape chart. And that is what is on this slide. And you look at this chart, it is overwhelming. There are hundreds of companies involved and they're all doing a little bit something different. I think it's probably pretty hard at this size considering how involved that chart is. But if you look at the labels on the chart, we've got data suppliers, data aggregators, data management companies, ad servers, networks, platforms, analytics, social media tools. The complexity is impressive. Everyone on that map is doing a little bit different. And the end result is that tons and tons of information is being moved around, and it's often happening automatically and at rapid speed, functionally the speed of light. And that is why I think it is really important that whenever companies talk publicly about protecting privacy as a matter of giving you notice and appropriate control, I sort of laugh at that as a privacy advocate, because how do you get notice and appropriate control over this? The complexity is really, I think, unfortunately, a good way to feel helpless. Next slide. So I've always sort of found that the best way, and this is just sort of an easy mental model, is to think about online advertising as basically middlemen on top of middlemen. And we'll get to this more later in the presentation. But at the end of the day, the end result is that an advertiser wants to place an ad with a publisher. And a publisher, back in the day, this was a page on a physical magazine. Now it is all sorts of multimedia in different places that can follow us around. This is our phone, this is our laptop, this is our smart television. Increasingly, you're going to see all sorts of targeted ads all over out there in the world. And I think it's important to acknowledge, if you look at this sort of simplified map, that everyone in this ecosystem thinks everyone else is taking too big of a cut. And that it can all just, if we can, we can solve that problem if it's all automated a little bit better. And the automation of digital advertising is what is known, there's an umbrella term known as programmatic advertising. And the reality is, over time, companies thought it was easier to simply just cut out the human middlemen in all of this. If you go back in the day, you're an advertiser and you had to go talk to a physical person at the newspaper to run your ad. That's been sort of replaced with all of these tech tools that automate the buying and selling of ads. I hope that makes some sense, but I think it's really important to understand that a lot of this is frankly being done automatically now. Programmatic advertising is, I have a little definition here, is an umbrella term to refer to all of the advertising technology that automates this process. An important component, and that's where we're finally getting to real-time bidding, a component of programmatic advertising is what is known as real-time bidding. And I think it's important to acknowledge that every time you load a web page, anytime you load an app, online auctions are running milliseconds, where ad impressions are bought and sold. This process begins the moment you visit a web page. When you visit a web page, this triggers a bid request that sends all sorts of data about your demographics, your race, your sexuality, your health status, your political affiliation. And this is on top of other information about browsing, location, whether you're on an Android or Apple device or running Microsoft Windows, your IP address, the page being loaded, a whole bunch of technical information. All of that data goes to an advertising exchange, which is then where it gets submitted to all of these other little players in the ecosystem, DSPs and SSPs. And then advertisers that have an ad that meets those demographics. So for example, advertisers always go with things like innocuous ads, like shoes and Marvel movies. But it can be really sort of sensitive information too, about, trying to reach people with health conditions, trying to play on people's emotions and vulnerabilities. But anybody that has an ad that meets certain types of these qualifications sends in a bid response and are entered into the auction. And then an auction takes place. And this is an auction that is like fractions of a penny on a dollar here. And they're bidding on thousands and thousands of ad impressions. The scale of real-time bidding is really phenomenal. And so it's an auction. And so the impression or the ad is delivered to the highest bidder, and then their ad gets served on the page. And I think it's important to note that this all happens in about 200 milliseconds. The scale of this is crazy. And the challenge, and I think the privacy problem, is that all of these companies are receiving all of this information. And there's just not a lot of accountability there. I think really provocatively, folks have called this real-time bidding ecosystem the largest data breach in history, because every single second, our information is being spilled out to hundreds and hundreds of companies. And there's very little ability to know who those companies are, let alone control it. And you know, if that doesn't strike you as a harm by itself, my colleague Ariel is here to talk about what we see as some actual more tangible harms are.
Thanks, Joe. For me, that strikes me as a harm as an adult, but our focus at Common Sense is kids and teens in particular, and certainly a harm for them. If we could go to the next slide, please. So all of this targeted ads and this real-time bidding, it's not just happening to you and to other adults, it's also happening to children and teenagers. And at Common Sense, we don't think that this is a good thing. And, you know, we're not the only ones who don't think this is a good thing. Children themselves think this is a bad thing. They think it is creepy. They think it is unfair. It feels like people are secretly listening to you. So as I mentioned, the European privacy commissioners and other folks are starting to look into this, and there's growing awareness about problems with a surveillance advertisements and the targeted ad business model. The Irish Data Protection Commission did a study into how kids feel about online privacy and how they feel about personalized ads, and then has come up with some recommendations based on that. But these quotes that you're seeing about, you know, feeling like companies are stalking you are what actual children had to say when they learned about how targeted personalized advertisements work. Our own Common Sense research and other research is consistent with this too. You know, we did a poll of US teenagers and found that 2/3 of them were worried about how social networking sites were using their data to allow advertisers to target them with things. And my guess is that most of the teenagers just thought, you know, the social media sites were sharing with a few advertisements or half a dozen, not the hundreds that is actually happening behind the scenes. Next slide, please. So children are not interested in getting targeted ads. Families are not interested in them getting these targeted ads. In addition to your sort of personal information being leaked all over the web, targeted ads and the fact of them being shown to you can also expose personal aspects of children's lives that they may wish to keep hidden. You know, based on your browsing, you might be shown advertisements that show religious or sexual orientation or other preferences that you might not wish other people in a room with you to see. And this has been going on for a long time. One of the initial privacy harms stories of over a decade ago was when Target made a guess based on a consumer's purchasing habits that they were pregnant. And this was a teenage girl. And they sent to her house a mailer full of lots of baby cribs and strollers and other items that someone expecting a child might want to purchase. As the story goes, her father was irate and called upset that they were getting these mailers. And then later he talked to his daughter and it turned out that she was expecting. Most individuals would prefer to have that conversation on their own terms and not because they received a targeted advertisement. These are very highly complex commercial systems, and kids are very much unassuming unwilling targets, I think. The explanation that you got from Joe just now, it was both pretty high level and also, you know, complicated, because this is a complex system and it's hard, not that Joe's explanation was complicated, but the fact of real-time bidding is complicated. And it's hard to sort of explain it simply to adults. So it's very hard for children to understand what's going on in this targeted advertising ecosystem. I mean, people have like classes and hours and seminars and trainings to understand how this stuff all works. So how is a kid supposed to understand it? Next slide, please. What's more, kids are also extremely vulnerable online to targeted ads and to other privacy harms. As we know, kids are historically have been shown to be more vulnerable to advertisements in general. Anyone who's taken a child to the grocery store and seen that they gravitate immediately towards the cereal with cartoon characters knows that advertising works for kids. The personalization of targeted ads makes them even more powerful and hard for children to resist. The fact that kids might not even recognize that an ad is targeted to them makes that advertisement much more powerful. So we know, based on research mostly done with TV and earlier ads, that most children under 8 can identify an advertisement from other content. We also know that children up until about age 12 can have trouble identifying that the goal of an ad is to sell them something. Add to that the fact that many ads online are even harder to identify and detect. They can be mixed up with native content and articles. They can appear in apps and games. There's a term advergame, where the entire game is itself a large ad. It can be hard to tell while watching, you know, a social media video, what's an ad and what's content. To that, we add another layer of marketers fine-tuning a pitch specifically tailored to a particular child's whims and weaknesses. And kids are basically defenseless. That's why advertisers are interested in paying big money to find out precisely when and how kids will be most vulnerable to their messages. And for example, while there was a story a couple of years back of some Facebook marketing executives, you know, telling advertising executives that they could know exactly when teens were feeling sort of worthless and like they needed the most help, because that would help advertisers know when to target them with their products. Targeted ads also pose other risks for kids beyond just like more commercialism. Kids are growing up online and their brains are still developing. So they're still developing and deciding who they want to be themselves and what kind of individual and person they want to be. In other aspects of life, we encourage children to make mistakes, to try new things, and to find their voices. But online, that can't be what we're teaching them, because online, if you make a mistake, it can follow you around forever. Online, kids have to be very careful about finding their voice or expressing controversial opinions, because it may be impossible in future to overcome them if you're at a job or a school interview. Children are responding, you know, as one might expect, this surveillance. And in studies, we see that when children and teens feel that they're constantly being surveilled and monitored, they practice self-limiting. They don't say things that might be controversial. They limit their critical thinking, and they might limit other political activity or actions they want to take. So targeted ads are part of a system that, instead of encouraging kids to explore and engage and learn new things about the world, is really teaching them that they're already labeled, they're already limited. Targeted ads can identify children as interested in gambling and then show them casino shots. It can show kids who are already concerned about their weight, you know, other foods or weight loss pills or other dieting products. It's part of a larger system, as I mentioned. It's not just advertisements. It's personalized search results. It's personalized news feeds. It's all part of one system where a child's online reality is not the same as the kid on the street, let alone the kid across town. And this is very concerning for kids. We also don't know that it's making companies that much money. And I'll turn back to Joe to talk about the business side.
Next slide. It's a really interesting question if you get into the weeds on all of this about whether it's really worth it in light of everything Ariel just mentioned. I think it's really important. I think it's always fun to note that going back into the history of advertising, department store magnate John Wanamaker once said that half of the money that he spent on advertising was being completely wasted. And the problem he found was that he just didn't know which half of that was. And that impulse really underlies so much of what we're seeing here. Advertisers have been searching for metrics and some way to measure the effectiveness of their ads. And if that sounds a lot like we got to track things more and evaluate and collect more information, you're absolutely right. Targeted advertising and all of the data collection that goes with it, part of that is just a way that for companies to try to better measure who is seeing online, and this includes online and off, and then where they end up buying things in stores later. All of this tracking technology promised a big solution. The problem is, I think a lot of that enthusiasm is hype, and hype that the industry has spent a long, long time playing up while trying to sort of put Band-Aids on top of to fix. Why is this? As it says in the slide, there are academic research studies and industry's own studies have found that huge amounts of the money that's being spent on online targeted advertising is really just going to fake traffic and automated bots. If you remember my high-level conversation about real-time bidding, the goal is always to get eyeballs on ads. But there's not a whole lot that ensures that those are human eyeballs. And I think it's really important for folks to know that a huge amount of internet traffic is not being created by humans. It's being created by computers and bots. And so if you think about the way this sort of auction system works, if it's all being done automated, you're taking humans out of the loop, and it's all a bunch of tech tools, there's a lot of incentives to sort of just have bots buying and selling things and selling basically impressions to other bots. And the end result is just a huge amount of advertising fraud. The companies that make their money from talking about how effective targeted advertising is have routinely been found to be exaggerating their capabilities. Facebook, for example, admitted to inflating video viewership metrics. A couple years ago, you know, there was this constant push and pull. We have to, you know, if you were following the news media and the newspaper industry, there was this pivot to video. You know, no one wants to read anymore. We just have to have video. And all of that was being driven by this idea that there were more eyeballs, more metrics, and more advertising money to be made by on video. And that just wasn't actually the case. You've also got companies like Comscore, which you might historically know of as a, you know, sort of a media sort of viewership and analytics company. They do a lot of measuring of online advertising, and they've been charged by regulators with falsely reporting their revenue and they're misreporting customer numbers. So there's just a lot of skepticism that I think is warranted toward whenever any company says how effective this entire ecosystem is. Next slide, please. So I mentioned earlier that ad tech is middlemen upon middlemen, and that each of these entities, each of these middlemen, is taking a cut out of the ultimate advertising transaction. I think it's important to note that the two most dominant players in this ecosystem, which should be no surprise to anyone, we could do a poll, the two most dominant players are Google and Facebook. And those two companies alone, I mean, they actually own all the different pieces of that Lumascape that I showed earlier. So they've got the DSPs and the ad exchanges. And so the end result is at the end of the day, they're making up over 60% of all the online ad revenue that we're talking about here. So all of this revenue, everything that is advertisers trying to get ads in front of viewers' eyes and on newspapers and blogs, most of that is all going to Google and Facebook. And if you ask who the third biggest player is, well, their nearest competitor is, in some respects, I think it's Amazon. So the three biggest beneficiaries of this entire ecosystem are Google and Facebook and Amazon. And unfortunately, this has left media, traditional media, newspapers, really fighting over the scraps. And I think it's important to note that, like, that means at the end of the day, a blogger or a newspaper or an app that is running ads is really only getting 30 to 40 cents of every single dollar that is spent to advertise on their services. You know, if you are one of these publishers, if you are a newspaper, if you are a magazine, if you're someone trying to monetize your website, I think it is incredibly hard to understand the value that each of these ad tech companies is actually providing to you. And frankly, whether the fees that you're being charged by all these different intermediaries is commensurate with the value being offered. And I think, unfortunately, and this is something that Common Sense has really struggled with, too often when we talk to lawmakers and go talk to companies, they have bought into this narrative that the internet and frankly all online commerce will collapse without targeted advertising. I'm always a little bit amused to, you know, remember that the former director of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection insisted that YouTube would become a desert of crap without targeted ads. You know, there's plenty of crappy content already on YouTube. It's sort of questionable how the targeted ads are facilitating healthy and useful content on that platform. But, you know, the reality is that tech companies, you know, also have this sort of, they routinely conflate the ad-supported internet with targeted advertising. And unfortunately, they're not one and the same. Unfortunately, you know, we're trying to make the case that this isn't worth a whole lot. And one of the big problems is that much of the data about the supposed efficacy of targeted advertising, it's not available to watchdogs. It's not available to consumer advocates, kids advocates like us. It's not even available to regulators, unfortunately. The current acting chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, Commissioner Chairman Slaughter, has actually pointed out this irony and has highlighted repeatedly in public that she questions, you know, or wants to sort of see the evidence of the benefits of targeted advertising. And I think the reality is that the studies are mixed. They may frankly actually be pretty skeptical. Researchers at the University of Minnesota, the University of California, Irvine, and Carnegie Mellon University, they were some of the first to do a large-scale empirical study on the impact of targeted advertising on the revenue of websites. And they found that really websites are only getting about 4% more revenue from ad impressions that are targeted, you know, using cookie data and all of that other information I talked about earlier, than websites that aren't. Websites that are just sort of using contextual advertising, which basically means if you're, again, making a website that's about video games, you might have video game ads on it. If you're a website that is selling, you know, kitchen products, or you're frankly a cooking blog, you might have ads for kitchen products and food. That doesn't require hugely targeted information. You know, after the European Union's general data protection went into effect, 3 years ago now, the New York Times actually stopped, you know, you cut itself off from advertising exchanges in Europe, and frankly found that it could grow more ad revenue for itself. The paper's vice president of advertising actually called privacy laws that reduce reliance on third-party ad targeting and data a win-win-win for publishers, advertisers, and frankly, at the end of the day, people, kids and readers of this content. Contextual advertising has been shown to be, frankly, just as cost-effective as behaviorally targeted ads. And then I think it's always interesting to note that reducing reliance on ad tech also has benefits to internet users. All of those different players are loading code and material on websites. After USA Today removed its ad tech software from its European websites, the site not only had less of this tracking that is really problematic, but it also loaded faster. You know, a point of comparison 3 years ago was that USA Today's US website was 5.5 megabytes in size and included over 800 ad-related quests for information that was going to 188 different companies and domains. In contrast, the EU-facing site loaded with less than half a megabyte in size and didn't contain any of that tracking. Next slide, please. So, you know, against this backdrop, changes are coming, and we can talk about that. These are things like there's been a lot of news recently about Apple's app transparency or tracking transparency. There's also this sort of really complicated technical thing called that Google is operating called the Federated Learning of Cohorts. The reality is that law and tech are forcing changes. Unfortunately, a lot of the advertising industry has been very, 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 very slow to realize this. From our perspective, they've been trying to head off meaningful regulation and controls for years. Most of the major advertising trade associations routinely talk about privacy, not as privacy and protecting people from tracking, but simply as providing more information about the benefits of advertising. I always think it's great in a presentation to sort of put this icon on display because invariably almost no one has ever seen it and knows what it means. But this icon appears on almost all advertising that you will see online. It is supposed to be the way that you can opt out of targeted advertising. I in all of my years of talking about this, I think I've seen a handful of people, and it's often just when you're speaking sort of in the weeds to people that already do this stuff for a living, that they know anything about this. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that this is by design. Because data collection is the name of the game here, targeted advertising companies, they always begin from a position of assuming that targeted advertising is a net positive. And that all of these problems that we're talking about, they can just be resolved with some combination of user controls and consumer education. I think these efforts have been decidedly mixed. This icon is part of an ad choices program that nearly no one on this planet has ever heard of. I think it's worth giving these folks some credit that they were able to create some sort of standardized icon that could display on every ad. But I think it also highlights, again, how manipulative design and the manipulation at the core of advertising can be deployed to minimize anyone's engagement with these privacy tools. I'm probably getting a little bit into the weeds here, but this icon was actually chosen over other icons that more clearly communicated that this was a way for people to opt out of stuff. And even once you click on this icon that no one has seen and no one understands, you're sent to an opt-out tool. And there's a really phenomenal article from The Markup, which has been doing really excellent data-driven journalism earlier this year. You know, they tried to actually use these tools, this ability to opt out of targeted advertising. And, you know, they found sort of dismissively that the entire process left a lot to be desired. And they also, I think, pretty harshly suggested that the industry, quote, the opt-out wasn't really meant to help consumers so much as it was meant to stave off government intervention. And I think that's sort of what we're dealing with here. Letting people actually control whether they receive targeted advertising would in some respects defeat the entire purpose of targeted advertising. I'll turn things back over to Ariel now though.
Thanks, Joe. And unclear if things have gotten better for consumers or not with new ways of opting out or opting in to targeted advertisements. I think a little better though, we're still seeing manipulative design tactics. So as Joe was explaining, companies often go to great effort to sort of obscure consumers' choices and make it difficult for consumers to actually get what they want or even know what they might want to choose online. And a lot of this is due to manipulative design, also known as dark patterns. And manipulative design is sort of a design that is intentionally made so that individuals cannot make autonomous choices. It could be a design that's goal is to get you to give up more personal information, such as, you know, if you say you don't want to sign up for an email list, a crying puppy pops up and says, "Are you sure you don't want to sign up? You're missing out on all these great deals," or you're making Fido sad. It can be ways to compel compulsive usage among kids. So, you know, snap streaks are a classic example of this. If you don't share a message back and forth with a friend every day, your snap streak is gone. But you want to see those badges, you want to see those flashing lights and hear those dings. along with growing concerns about surveillance technology and ad tech in general, we're seeing growing concerns about the role that manipulative design plays online and how it can, for example, make it very hard for individuals to know what they are consenting to or even attempt to opt out of in terms of targeting advertisements. So as we mentioned, you know, companies make it difficult for consumers to say when they don't want targeted advertisements, if they really give them a choice at all. Recently, Apple launched a way for you to try to tell other apps and third parties, no, I don't want to be tracked and have that used for targeted advertisements and other purposes. And this has had, I think, sort of a huge effect in very, you know, recent and probably not peer-reviewed studies yet about what consumers actually want. I heard someone throw the statistic around that only like 6% of people were saying, yes, please do track me for ads and other purposes. So that's great. At the same time, we see that these third parties and other advertisers and companies are trying to get consumers to consent using the same tactics that have worked for them in the past. So this is the weather app asking if you want to be tracked on Apple. And it says that it helps save lives. So you're helping to save lives and keep the app free, you know, by allowing tracking. That's, you know, clearly designed to get people to say, okay, because who doesn't want to help the weather app save lives? So next slide, please. As we've seen, growing concerns about manipulative design with respect to targeting advertisements and other practices, and growing concern about surveillance business models. We're seeing efforts to rein in these practices across the world, and we think that these are critical. Some key ones to call out that are big in our space are the UK's age-appropriate design code, which will require companies, it's in effect and it's going to start being enforced in September. It's requires companies to prioritize the best interests of the child as they're designing their online services and experiences. Those come first, and it's a set of sort of 15 risk-based standards that are designed to put kids' interests first in online design. If a company is doing something that is detrimental to a child's well-being, such as using their personal information to target ads, or otherwise, you know, manipulating them and nudging them to give up more information than they might want to, that's a problem. Ireland, too, as I mentioned, has been digging into what's best for children, and they have proposed some draft fundamentals that state pretty clearly that using children's information and teenagers for targeted advertisements is going to be frowned upon. In California, Common Sense was a key sponsor of the California Consumer Privacy Act, and we supported an update to that this fall. This will now enable people not just to say no to the sale of their information, but it will also allow them to say no to the use of a lot of their information for targeted ad purposes to the extent companies are doing that themselves, like these big social media platforms that don't quote sell your information, and make clear that sharing for targeted advertisements is something that individuals can opt out of. For children under 16, these rights are generally opt-in, so they're prohibited from the get-go. I'm not going to presume to know the details of Bermuda's privacy law because we have those folks on the line with us. You can ask them. But that, understand that that is coming too, and that's going to require more protections for individuals' information and more respect of individuals. And that there are certain provisions that require specific care to be taken with children under the age of 14. This is great, and this is much needed. At Common Sense, we've been pushing for even more. We'd like, you know, a flat out ban on targeted advertisements, especially for younger children. We'd like very clear rules that would prohibit manipulative design, you know, across all of America. While we wait for this, and anyone who follows US Congress knows that it's not a good idea to hold your breath, there's a lot that we are asking companies to do and that we also try to support parents in doing, that we think that companies and parents can do on their own. And I'll turn back over to Joe. Thanks.
Next slide. So I sort of had a lot prepared on do's and don'ts here, but I think a lot of this is actually geared toward an industry audience. And I think it can largely, rather than just repeating out loud about the need to really explore additional business models and frankly, develop better relationships with consumers, I think a lot of what boils down to here is it'd be great if companies followed the spirit rather than the letter of the law. And this is I think, the case of privacy laws in the United States. It's certainly the case of some of the children's and student privacy laws that Common Sense works on. The reality is you've got a lot of aggressive companies that try to sort of weasel might be too negative of a word, but have done a lot to try to sort of insist that the law doesn't apply to the activities that they're engaged in. We have certainly seen that with the California Consumer Privacy Act, which necessitated improving that law. We have sort of seen that in a host of student privacy laws where, you know, companies try to find ways to sort of exfiltrate data or otherwise get outside of the system to do whatever they want with this information. And that just strikes us as fundamentally problematic. And, you know, when you see the sorts of dark patterns that we're seeing, and frankly, other groups are starting to catalog, it's really alarming because yes, in some respects, advertising and keeping people engaged online is a matter of manipulating people. But a lot of the stuff that we're seeing goes beyond the pale. The Federal Trade Commission hosted a workshop recently on dark patterns. And a lot of that focus was on how these things are being used against kids and even teens and other vulnerable populations that can't evaluate this information. So if you're a company and you say you know, privacy matters to you and that it is important to be transparent and give people actual choices, that all sounds good, but that all suggests that, you know, you shouldn't be deploying any of these types of things and that you should be frankly trying to minimize the information you're collecting and processing because really sensitive inferences can be used in really offensive ways. But, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, I want to do a plug for the resources that Common Sense and others have put together. I put this in the chat, and this is unfortunately, and right now, a little bit California specific because of the way the United States works. But we've created an information page at donotsell.org that at least goes through some of the rights under the CCPA in a clear manner. One of the real challenges, and I think this is certainly true of the privacy regulators like the privacy commissioner face, is communicating all of these really dense and complicated laws to individuals and families. You know, very frequently we say things like the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation is the gold standard of privacy, but you know, that gold standard doesn't mean a whole lot if people don't know about the law, don't know how to exercise their rights, and frankly, you deal with you know, regulators that are you know, under-resourced. I think we encourage folks to complain and stay engaged. And certainly on the next slide, you have the contact information for Ariel and I, and please feel free to reach out with any questions or concerns or anything we could follow up on.
Thank you.
Well, and thank you both for joining us today. This was a wonderful conversation. You've really condensed a lot of material into a very productive discussion. So thank you very much. I'm going to stop the recording now, and then we can have a less formal conversation with folks on the line. But before I do, I'll mention Ariel posted in the comment section, and you can also find it on our website, privacy.bm. a guest blog that she wrote that has some great material and also a few other links that you can follow as well. And I'll update that with some of the other things that we've put in the chat going forward. So thank you very much, Ariel and Joe. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.